Hello everyone, thanks for coming along to our talk this morning, and thanks to the organisers for enabling me to come to Waterloo. So today I'm going to be talking about a very old and well-studied problem in quantum measurement theory, which I have a couple of new results on from recent work. And the problem kind of has a sort of very straightforward interpretation in terms of communication. If we imagine we have Alice and Bob, as usual, and we imagine Alice encoding a number between 1 and n as a quantum state, and Alice sends it to Bob, and Bob has to measure the quantum state in order to determine which number Alice sent him. And obviously in quantum theory we know that normal problem or quantum states can't be distinguished with certainty, so we're interested in the question of for a given set of states that Alice chooses, what's Bob's optimal probability of success in determining this number k? And more formally, we can write this down as this simple optimization problem. If we have an ensemble of n quantum states that have known a priori probabilities of being sent, then given an unknown state that's picked in accordance with those probabilities from this ensemble, what's the optimal probability of success in identifying this state? That is the maximum over all measurements of probability of identifying the state with that measurement. And we're considering all sort of generalized measurements. And we can think about this quantity as the distinguishability of this ensemble of states. So in particular, we're considering a sort of simple scenario where we just have one sharp measurement and we want to make an identification immediately. There are obviously lots of other different criteria we could consider as well.
Sorry, to understand the problem you're given, you're choosing one state from the ensemble, and you just get one, how many copies do you get?
One copy.
Just one copy.
Just a single copy, yeah. So it's kind of the most basic possible scenario for this kind of problem. So lots of authors have considered this problem over the last 30 plus years, and a number of different sort of titles like quantum hypothesis testing and state discrimination and so on. And there have been different optimality criteria considered, such as maximizing the mutual information between the measurement results and the initial distribution, and unambiguous discrimination and such. But this criterion is kind of a nice straightforward one. And in the case where we have two states in the ensemble, then Hellstrom, again back in the 70s, derived an analytic expression for this optimal probability. But in the case where we have more than two states in the ensemble, then it appears intractable to find an analytic expression for this, although we can come up with a good numerical solutions to this using semi-definite programming and other techniques, possibly. So we're kind of led to the question of, can we produce lower bounds on this probability of success? For example, this would be useful in all sorts of areas in quantum information theory, such as quantum algorithms, where we end up with a set of, where say we're interested in identifying something, and at the end of our algorithm we have a set of states, and we want to know what the maximum probability of success of identifying the state is. So in this talk, it's kind of split into two parts. In the first part, I'm going to discuss two new lower bounds I've obtained on the probability of success of distinguishing these states, one of which is kind of local because it only considers pairwise distinguishability of states in the ensemble, and one of which is kind of global because it considers overall properties of the ensemble. And in the second part, I'm going to talk about applications of this to a specific scenario where we consider the states in our ensemble to be random, in a certain definition of randomness, and then applications of these results to a couple of problems, one which is kind of a physical problem and one of which is kind of a computational problem. So there's going to be a bit of notation that's going to be consistent throughout the talk, hopefully. So I'm just going to introduce it all here, though hopefully it should all be fairly self-explanatory. But I'm always going to use curly E for the ensemble of states that I want to distinguish between. And these are states psi I, where I runs between 1 and n. And we have pi for the a priori probability of the ith state, n the number of states, and d is the dimension for the states. More notation. There are going to be a few matrices that we're going to be using. S is going to be the, what I'm calling a state matrix, which is literally just writing all of the states as columns next to each other, renormalized in terms of their a priori probabilities. And also we have rho, which is, as usual, the density matrix of the states. And also G, the gram matrix, which encodes all of the inner products between the states. So in a sense, it encodes their pairwise distinguishability. And also just this notation P, M, is the probability of success of measurement M applied to one spot. Okay, so as I said, part one. I'm going to start by explaining how I'm going to use a specific measurement to lower down to the distinguishability of these states. So the measurement that I'm going to use, I'm going to produce a lower bound on its probability of success, is this so-called pretty good measurement, which probably a lot of you are familiar with already. It was defined a few years ago by a number of people, including Hausland and Wooters in a paper in 1994. And it has a number of nice properties. For pure states, we define it by a set of measurement operators, mu I, which I've got up there, which we can sort of write down in this sort of very straightforward way, sort of mathematically. We can straightforwardly show that this actually is a valid measurement, i.e. the sum of these measurement operators is the identity. So pretty good measurement has a number of nice properties. As we've just seen, you can define it analytically for any set of states. A particularly nice thing about it is that in this criterion of optimality, it's almost optimal for any ensemble. It only differs from the optimal measurement by a sort of quadratic factor in its probability of success. This was proven by Barnum and Knell a few years ago. There's actually quite a straightforward proof of it, but I don't think quite enough time to go into it. For us, a particularly nice thing about it is that we can write down the probability of success with the pretty good measurement in quite a straightforward way, which I'll use in the rest of the talk. The key fact that we're going to use is that if we have the gram matrix of this ensemble where we scale the states in the ensemble by their a priori probabilities, then the probability of success of the pretty good measurement can be written down solely in terms of this gram matrix, namely as the sum of the squares of the diagonal entries of the square root of the gram matrix, which again I'm not going to prove because I don't think I've got time, but it's quite easy to convince yourself of that just from the definition. So the very nice thing about this is that it means that we can come up with lower bounds or indeed upper bounds on the probability of success of the pretty good measurement simply by coming up with bounds on the properties of the square root of the gram matrix, which is the same as saying coming up with bounds on the properties of the square root of any positive semidefinite matrix. So we've kind of turned the problem into a very sort of matrix theoretic problem. So the first lower bound that I'm going to come up with is based on a strategy in this paper with a quantum noiseless channel coding theorem, which is based on considering the entries of the gram matrix producing a bound on the...
Just wondering, the formula... Bounding, giving a success probability in terms of root g diagonal elements. Is that a previously known result, or is that?
That's previously known.
Where is that from?
So it's certainly in this paper of Hausland and Joseph Schumacher and Wooters. It may already be in the paper of Hausland and Wooters from a couple of years before. I don't know. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. So Okay. So it's kind of quite natural to come up with a lower bound in terms of these sort of pairwise in the products, because we kind of think, well, if all the states in the ensemble are distinguishable from each other, then the overall thing is going to be quite distinguishable, which isn't always true, but sometimes it can give us good bounds. The mathematics to do this is very straightforward. What we need to do is put a lower bound on the square root function, and it's enough to give us a lower bound on the diagonal entries of the square root of the Gramer matrix. So this was done in this paper with this specific parabola, which I've graphed here, which is fairly arbitrary, but gives a fairly good bound. But in fact, we can do better than that if we optimize this parabola.
And what are the axes on that?
This graph is simply plotting square root of x against three. There's no kind of there's nothing more complicated than that going on. We can improve this bound while still sticking, I guess I should stress, to some very simple mathematics by producing an optimal set of parabolae. Rather than the kind of arbitrary one which I just drew on the previous slide. So in order to do this, we look for constants such that square root of x is bigger than this parabola parameterized by these constants, and such that this lower bound on the diagonal entries of the square root of the Gramer matrix is maximized. You can work this out again quite easily, and the answer is that you get this fairly nice lower bound coming out, which is easy to write down and simplifies sort of still further if all of the a priori probabilities are the same, which is often the case. So that's basically that for the first bound. There's the second lower bound that I've come up with is based on a sort of more global measure of the distinguishability of the states in this ensemble, which is the eigenvalues of the Gramer matrix. So this is a previous case was where we imagined that we know all of the inner products of the ensemble, but maybe we don't know anything else about it. And this one we got as far as knowing the eigenvalues of the Gramer matrix, but maybe we don't know the eigenvectors or the Gramer matrix totally. But this bound is also quite straightforward to produce, and in fact the proof is so simple I can do it here for once. We start out with this simple equality. We know that the sum of the diagonal entries of the square root of the Gramer matrix is the same as the sum of the square roots of the eigenvalues of the Gramer matrix. So clearly this follows, we can just square both sides. Then we can use a Cauchy-Schwarz inequality to produce this statement. And then that's sufficient to say that the probability of success of the pretty good measurement is at least as big as this average of the square of the, sorry, not the average, the sum of the square roots of the eigenvalues squared and then divided by n. This also has a nice interpretation in terms of the trace norm, because this is simply the a rescaling of the square trace norm of the state matrix, which was the matrix we got by writing all of the states in columns in the matrix. So it's the same as the sum of the singular values of this matrix squared divided by n. I guess an interesting feature about this bound is that it's like four lines to prove it, and it's very simple, but it seems quite difficult to actually improve it much. Like I've tried a number of different approaches to kind of get a better bound just in terms of the eigenvalues, and it sort of seems to fail. So there have been a number of previous authors that have also produced lower bounds on these on this probability of success. As far as I know, the bounds that I've given here are a bit stronger. And kind of a nice thing about these bounds is that they always give you some kind of non-trivial value, whatever the states are. By non-trivial, I mean a value that's at least as big as 1 over n, which is the probability of success. You can just guess which state you're given. And in fact, we can compare them. These new bounds are very similar to, or based on similar principles to the previous lower bounds, but but they're just a bit better. In a minute, I'm going to be kind of concerned about various constant factors we get in these lower bounds, so it's kind of nice to make this as good as possible.
Sorry, is that always better, or just better in some cases?
Always better.
Are you assuming here that the states are equally likely?
In this table, because just to make it easier, because in this previous paper they assumed that they were equally likely. Just for comparison, but my bounds don't assume that previously. I mean, this is just a simplification of the previous one, assuming that they do have equal probabilities. But this bound is the same whether they do or don't. And in fact, it's kind of an interesting question whether you could improve it given some knowledge of the a priori probabilities of the states, but I haven't been able to use yet. But in fact, later on, the applications that I'm coming up with I'm going to have uniform a priori probabilities. So, okay, so an interesting thing about these two bounds, as I mentioned earlier, is that the first bound only considers pairwise distinguishability between the states, but the second one considers sort of global features of the ensemble. So we already know that there are cases where you can have ensemble of states that are pairwise distinguishable but not globally distinguishable, for example, quantum fingerprinting. So we might expect the latter bound to be stronger, and it turns out that in fact this is a straightforward case where this is true, where if you have an ensemble of n states, each of which have the same inner product, which is, say, we assume is a positive real number, then it's possible to show that the first one of two bounds gives a sort of trivial result, so you might as well just guess. But the second bound is much stronger, in fact, basically optimal.
So your strong bound depends only on the Gram matrix?
Both the bounds depend only on the Gram matrix.
Okay. Yes.
I mean, in fact, in these problems, that's all you ever... this all probability of success can depend on at all. Because it's up to unitary equivalence. The probability of identifying the states is the same. So, okay. Right, so in this case, I guess I should mention that we can the Gram matrix of these states, we can just write it down, and because it's so simple, we can diagonalize it and we can calculate the exact probability of success for principal measurement. So,
So is the global bound always better than the local one?
That's a good question, and I don't actually know the answer. I would conjecture that it is, but I don't know the answer to that. In this case, we can actually calculate the probability of success with a pretty good measurement exactly, but it just provides a sort of a nice example of where we can get a much better result from the global bound. Okay, so that's whistle stop tour through part one. So now part two is going to be kind of applying these bounds, or in particular applying the second bound, to a case where we have random quantum states in our ensemble. I'm going to kind of define what that means in a second. Basically I'm going to be using this second bound based on the eigenvalues of the Gram matrix to put a lower bound on how easy to distinguish these random states are. And then it turns out there are a couple of applications of this. Okay, so what do we mean by a random quantum state? Again, maybe some of you are familiar with this. So our first definition of random quantum state, which I'm actually going to generalize a bit in a minute, the first definition is that we have an ensemble of these states, psi I, where each state, psi I, is distributed uniformly at random on the d-dimensional complex unit sphere, so that's according to Hahn measure, and we're assuming that all of the states are equally probable. And we're going to calculate the expected probability of success of identifying the state that we were sent in this case. So kind of, we're given a state picked at random from a known set of states which are themselves picked at random, and we need to determine which random state our randomly picked state is. which kind of sounds pretty stupid, but there are probably one of, well, there are one or two sort of applications of this contrived sounding situation. So, yeah, I guess it's just important to remember the two different kinds of randomness. So how do we actually produce or write down such a state that's distributed uniformly at random? Well, basically, all we need to do is we need to produce a vector whose components are complex Gaussians, and then we just need to normalize this vector. And then because of the spherical symmetry of the multivariate normal distribution or multivariate Gaussian, then we end up with something that's uniformly distributed on the complex unit sphere. So kind of you can just write that down there explicitly. So I'm going to be using this property of uniformly distributed quantum states if I wanted to analyze them. So one interesting thing is that when we're at high dimension, this normalization step, it turns out, becomes almost unnecessary because the norm of the vector that we get is already very sharply concentrated around its expected value. So it turns out that we can pretty much just blindly rescale it without having to bother with the normalization step, which will be important. And I'm not sure if I've got time to sort of go into the rigorous details behind that, but you can sort of write down something rigorous rather than saying it's almost unnecessary. So this state matrix S that we have, which again is just writing down the states as columns in a matrix, is simply again up to this normalization being unnecessary. It's just a rescale matrix with whose entries are complex Gaussians, and in order to use this lower bound on the distinguishability of the states in this ensemble, we need to calculate the expected value of this function of that matrix, which is simply the lower of the eigenvalue bound that I mentioned a minute ago. So does that make sense? Okay. We're interested in calculating a function of a matrix of random variables. So unsurprisingly, the thing we need to do that is random matrix theory. As again, I guess a lot of you know, random matrix theory deals with the properties of matrices whose entries are random variables. And in particular, there are a number of interesting questions we can ask about such matrices that random matrix theory tries to provide an answer to. And a particular case where you can get nice results from this field is where the matrix is actually sort of of infinite size, or I guess I should say we have a family of matrices that are parameterized by size, and as the size goes to infinity, then random matrix theory allows us to say things about the limits of functions of these matrices. So in particular, kind of the almost the canonical question of random matrix theory, as I understand it, is what's the density of the eigenvalues of these matrices as the dimension of the matrices goes to infinity. And we have to rescale this by some number, like one over n, in order to get something meaningful coming out here. But in any case, it's not always obvious that there should be a limiting density of these eigenvalues. It's not obvious that these random matrices are well behaved. But luckily, it turns out that they usually are. And in particular, the sort of matrices that I'm going to be interested in are these sample covariance matrices, which are simply the product of a random matrix S and the conjugate transpose of that random matrix. We can think this matrix S is the state matrix, and so S times S dagger gives us the grand matrix, essentially, of this ensemble, because it encodes all the inner products between the states. With this kind of matrix, if the certain conditions, which I'll just explain in a minute, are satisfied, the density of eigenvalues of this matrix is given by this so-called Marchenko-Pasteur law from 1967. And many of you are familiar with it. This is kind of the equivalent of the Wigner semicircle law for random emission matrices. So what is this Marchenko-Pasteur law? We can write this down And it's fortunately a big equation, sorry about that. Basically, if we have a family of matrices where the number of rows and number of columns, of the ratio between the number of rows and the number of columns of this matrix tends to some constant as the size of the matrix goes to infinity, and the entries of this matrix are independent, identically distributed complex random variables with this mean and this variance, then as the size of this sort of family of random matrices goes to infinity, then we can say that the eigenvalues of the matrix we get by multiplying this random matrix with its conjugate transpose the eigenvalues of this matrix tend to a limiting distribution that has density given by this. So we can see that this is only sort of supported on this in this region between 1 minus root r squared and 1 plus root r squared and 0 sort of elsewhere. So kind of what this is saying is that the eigenvalues of this matrix are kind of concentrated within this sort of fairly narrow region, which depends on this ratio. And within this region, they sort of follow this density. Instead of thinking about the eigenvalues of this matrix, we're actually interested here in the singular values of the matrix. So we can just change the result slightly, make a couple of sort of substitutions, and we get something that tells us about singular values instead. And there's a picture. Now, the nice thing about random matrix theory is that you can actually do experiments. And here's kind of an experiment that which is 500 by 500 matrix whose entries are Gaussians. And here we're plotting the bars are the number of the density of the eigenvalues basically between each different slot, picked sort of fairly arbitrarily, and the blue line is the density predicted by this Marchenko-Pastor law. So you can see that in this sort of fairly small dimension, the density of these singular values actually follows the Marchenko-Pastor law quite closely. So given that we're sort of armed with this ability to sort of think about the singular values of this matrix, it enables us to write down something about the distinguishability of the states that correspond to this matrix. So the first thing we need to do, because this sort of distinguishability lower bounds is sort of based on the trace norm of the state matrix, the first thing we need to do is sort of, again, tweak the previous bound in order to tell us about the trace norm, which we can do very easily because the trace norm is simply the sum of the singular values. So we can figure out the expected trace norm based on this Marchenko-Pastor law. So what we have here is basically the expected trace norm of a rectangular matrix whose entries are random as the dimensions of the matrix go to infinity. And you can see that it's got this sort of integral in it, which isn't very nice. It turns out that this integral is actually an elliptic integral that doesn't have any analytic solutions. Luckily for us, we can actually find a good lower bound on this integral. So we can write down this part of the formula being greater than or equal to this, because at the end of the day we're only interested in coming up with lower bounds anyway. Unfortunately, again, proof's a bit complicated, so I probably can't go through it. But once we've done that, that's kind of almost all the pain out of the way. And we can get to what I guess is like the main theorem that the paper is based on, which is if we have such an ensemble of random constant states, and the number of the ratio of the number of states in the ensemble to the dimension approaches a constant as the size of the states and the dimension go to infinity, and the components of the states in some basis satisfy this condition about the mean and variance and their identical distribution, then we can write down an expression for the expected probability of success of the pretty good measurement. So this gives us a lower bound on the expected probability of success of the optimal measurement on these states. The nice thing is about these random states is that concentration and measure results show that these results actually hold for almost all states. So we can say that sort of in high dimension with probability 1, if you give me an ensemble of n states that are d-dimensional, then the expected probability of success of me distinguishing which state I was given from this ensemble is at least that value there.
So probably a really dumb question, but as R becomes approaching zero, the first thing approaching infinity.
So this. If n is bigger than d, then R can't be zero. There'll be a graph in a second which will hopefully make it make sense. Okay, so here's a picture. The graph counts as a picture. Basically, what this is plotting is this asymptotic lower bound on the probability of success of pretty good measurement versus numerical results for the actual probability of success of the pretty good measurement, which we can get by explicitly calculating this sum of the squares of the diagonal matrix of the diagonal elements of the square root of the Gram matrix. So in this case, sort of this axis is the ratio between number of states and dimension, and this axis is probability of success of pretty good measurement. So we can see that if we have R equals zero, then that means we have a very small number of states and very large dimensions, so we would expect they'd be easy to distinguish, which is true, identical to property one. Whereas at the other extreme, we have a large number of states in small dimension, so they're hard to distinguish between. The important thing is that the lower bounds here tracks the numerical results quite closely. If I hadn't gone to the pain of using this random matrix theory and had used just this sort of pairwise bound instead, which is easier to apply, then I'd have something that looks like this. I could draw it a laser pointer, but it wouldn't have the same shape. It's just the same graph, but extended to a larger region. You can see that as the ratio increases, then the lower bound tracks the numerical data even more closely. I glossed over a couple of technicalities about finite dimension, basically it turns out that we don't need to worry about any such technicalities, because firstly, the fact that all of these ensembles of states are actually finite dimensional states rather than actually infinite dimensional isn't the problem, because there's a convergence result we can use by Bai from 1999, which says that which bounds the rate in which they approach this sort of infinite dimensional case, and also the fact that we're normalizing rather than just rescaling, we don't have to worry about, because we have a sort of tail bound that says that normalization doesn't make much difference. Okay, and this is the x-axis is kind of the infinite dimension expected probability of success, and you can see that sort of numerically it converges very, very quickly. So this is number of dimensions, and this is probability of success. So just a quick motivational slide. So why do we bother with these random states? Firstly, as I said earlier, almost all states are actually random, so kind of nice that we can say something about almost all quantum states using these results. Also, it's kind of nice that we can figure out how distinguishable these states are just based on these two parameters, the number of states and the dimension. And also, as you've just seen from the graph, we can get very tight results. And finally, you can say, this is very vague and waffly, that if your states are like random states, then that means that they're probably quite distinguishable. But what if we don't actually care about quantum measurement at all, and we just want some kind of other applications of this? So one application is that it turns out that this distinguishability function that I've been playing with all the talk kind of actually gives the fidelity of the Gram matrix G with the maximally mixed state in that dimension. So kind of what this eigenvalue lower bound is actually telling us is how close the Gram matrix of the states is to maximally mixed state. So it's me. This means that we can use this in the following way. If we have a density matrix given by taking a uniformly random state on a higher space and tracing out some of the space, then we end up with something that looks like this kind of mixed state on the smaller space. And it's possible to show that the eigenvalues of this thing that are non-zero are actually the same as the eigenvalues of the Gram matrix of the set of random states as I've been considering. So we can show that this distinguishability function I've been thinking about gives the approximate fidelity of this mixed state with the maximally mixed state. So this means that where we can predict, given a state in a large subsystem, if we trace out a certain amount of it, we can predict quite closely how close the result is to the maximally mixed state, which was a similar result to one obtained by Basco, Short, and Winter recently by a different method. And finally, kind of running out of time, but there's one application to quantum computation as well. We can consider this oracle identification problem, which was kind of introduced a few years ago by Ambinus and some co-authors, where we're given a Boolean function as an oracle that's picked uniformly at random. At least this is the subcase of the problem I'm considering. It's picked uniformly at random from a set of Boolean functions on n bits. And we want to identify which function we were given with the minimum number of uses of it. So it turns out that unstructured search, like Graves' algorithm, fits into this this framework, and so do many other sort of interesting search problems in quantum computing. So classically, we're doomed to have at least log the number of functions in the set queries in order to find the function that we were given, because these functions are Boolean, and each call can only reduce the size of the search space by half. And also, being allowed some bounded probability of error isn't actually any use, because even if we get down to only having two potential functions that might be the one we want in our set, we still can't just guess. But it turns out for almost all sets of functions, we need to log n queries classically, because if we have random functions, then most queries reduce the search space by almost half. But in the quantum case, we have a much more sort of encouraging scenario. For almost all sets of functions, we can actually identify the Boolean function with a constant number of quantum queries, assuming that the domain of the function is large relative to the number of functions we want to distinguish between. So the algorithm, so-called, for doing this is very straightforward. We just create a uniform superposition and apply the unknown function to it. And then we just use the pretty good measurement to distinguish between all the states and the resulting ensemble. And when these Boolean functions in the ensemble are picked at random, then it turns out that this state matrix of these states is actually random in the sense that I described earlier, because each of the entries in the state matrix is independent, identically distributed, has expected value 0, and has the right variance. So This means that the results here can be used to put the same lower bound on the probability of success of distinguishing these states. And in particular, the input size and the number of functions determine this probability. So this means if we have a very large domain, then a quantum computer can use this in a way that classical computers cannot, because they just can't see all of the input at once. And again, this holds for almost all sets of functions. And if the probability of success is bigger than half, we can simply repeat the algorithm a constant number of times for an arbitrarily good probability of success. Okay, this is the end. So the summary is that we can come up with good lower bounds for the probability of success in distinguishing between pure states. Bounds could actually be extended to mixed states, but I mentioned that in this talk. And we can apply these to random quantum states and get some quite tight results. So for example, if we have n random states in dimensions, we can distinguish them with this constant quite high probability. And same goes for almost all sets of Boolean functions. And there are a few possible future directions, such as upper bounds, and as mentioned earlier, sort of multiple copies is quite interesting. And also, there might be further applications of these results to quantum computation, which would be nice. Okay, this is the end. Thanks very much.
So, your graph matrix can be obtained as either S dagger or S dagger S, right?
Yes.
Then if you do the other way around, you get the density matrix.
Yes, you do. Exactly.
So, those are going to have the same eigenvalues.
Yes.
And so, when R is large, something that's bothering me is that most of the eigenvalues of the Gram matrix have to be zero, because N is much bigger than D.
Yes.
But the random matrix law that you showed doesn't give a delta function at zero.
Ah, yes. Yes, there is a bit of sleight of hand in the fact that, hopefully I got it right when I did the slides. You kind of play around with this ratio a bit to ensure that it's always in the right place, so you don't have this spike. So, for example,
so basically, you're gonna do the smaller of n or d.
Yes, and then cheat to avoid the spike, basically. Exactly. So in this case, I kind of cheat by making this ratio being between 0 and 1, and then it turns out to be irrelevant later. I mean, you kind of have to be quite careful when you're doing it to make sure that your d's and your n's don't get mixed up and that you do take account for the zero eigenvalues. But
yeah, that makes sense.
But I think, hopefully it's.
When you define R, you're finding it later, it's essentially the ratio of n over d.
Yes.
So for R less than 1,
yes,
you've got more dimensions than you have states.
So, yes.
So does that not just mean you're considering too high a number of dimensions?
Do
you see what I mean? Because if you have n pure states, then they occupy at most n dimensions.
Yes, this is true. If you have, say, two pure states and they're very, very high dimensional, then their inner product is going to be very low, and it's going to depend on the dimension. So,
but they still span two dimensions.
Yes, so they still span two dimensions. However, the distinguishability does depend on.
Because you're considering random states.
Random states. Yes. Yeah. Quite right.
So you're. This is based on the optimal distinguishability.
Yeah. It's
pretty good measurements.
Yeah.
Is there either any way to extend it to different measures of distinguishability, or is there an obvious boundary to doing that?
So this is roadblock. An interesting question. So do you have anything in mind? Because
there are, for example, unambiguous.
So it's an interesting question. From what I remember when I looked at it, I don't think the results here with the eigenvalues really help you much, the unambiguous discrimination. But I mean, that is an interesting question I'd like to
Do you have any intuition as to whether a random set of states are apparently reasonably distinguishable or not?
Yes. So I would expect that they would be unambiguously distinguishable, like quite well, simply because of the fact that you're going to get all of the sort of a lot of linear independence type properties that you would, which is I guess what you need for unambiguous discrimination. So, for example, if you have n dimensional random states, then they will span space with probability 1. So, my intuition would say that they'd be very good candidates for general ambiguous discrimination.
We'll put Daniel, Richard, and then we'll go to the next talk.
Okay. So for the Oracle distinguishability question, you said that 2 to the little n, you're assuming that 2 to the little n was bigger than big N, was significantly bigger than big N?
So my results just basically say that this problem is equivalent to the state.
Yeah, no, sure. So I meant for the constant number of...
Oh, yes. Yeah. I missed off these slides, but it turns out that if you want the probability of success to be at least as big as 1/2, which is what you need to be able to repeat it, then it's sufficient to take 2 to the n to be, I think, as big as... take big N to be as big as 1.662 to the n.
Okay,
so
a constant.
So a constant, yeah, fraction. So you don't need to know it to be very large.
So just a very basic question about pretty good measurement. At the beginning you said that it's distinguishing probability is the lower bound by the square of the that's the optimal measure.
Yes.
And is that tight?
That's a good question. So I would think, so the proof basically just uses a couple of Cauchy-Schwarz inequalities. So I would very much think that it is tight, but I can't actually... So there's a trivial tight case where the probability of success is 1 in both cases. But, apart from that, I don't know any sort of interesting relations. I would be very surprised if it's not tight, just based on the sort of simplicity of the proof. So
the square root measure of the dark field is very symmetric as well. So then it's the tight.
Looks like Ashley.